gerrymandering in their constitution. So it's not as easy as it would be in Texas to gerrymander. At least in California, they seem to be developing a plan to pass new maps and then have voters approve them in a special vote, basically, that would take place in November. That's the latest plan that I've seen. It's risky. It could get blocked by the courts. The voters could reject it if that happens. But I think that Californians and in New York and other blue states, they feel like they have a moral duty to respond, that if the maps get so rigged in the Republican direction, Democrats have no choice but to draw their own new districts. Now, what I worry about, Amy, is that we're going to be a race to the bottom here, that there's going to be retaliatory districting happening from red and blue states, and something that's very abnormal, which is the redrawing of districts mid-decade, will become normalized because of what Trump did. And the reason this is happening is because we don't have federal legislation banning partisan gerrymandering, and we have a Supreme Court that said that this kind of partisan gerrymandering is okay. And that has really led to a race to the bottom for states to do these kind of tit-for-tat gerrymanderings. And I'm worried about where it ends.
Ari Berman, we want to thank you so much for being with us, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your latest piece, Trump's Texas Gerrymander is Supercharging a New War on Democracy. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
I'm Don Jacobson, host of Movin' On, Fridays right after the noon news. Not only does Movin' On feature folk music, but every Monday through Friday, 5:30 to 7 a.m., you can hear a different host bringing you folk music that is engaging, intelligent, heartfelt, humorous, profound, entertaining, and relevant. It is accessible right here on KBOO. Please take this opportunity to invest in a radio station that dares to bring you folk music that you cannot hear anywhere else. Go to KBOO.fm/give, text to KBOO at 44321, or click on donate on your mobile app. Whatever you can afford, your generosity is greatly appreciated. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Reed College faces scrutiny for giving an alumni's personal information to the FBI without a warrant.
Oregon makes moves to protect the state's beaver population.
And in international news, Trump's special envoy and U.S. ambassador are taking a curated tour of the GHF's so-called aid sites in Gaza.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 1st, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Reed College campus security helped the FBI find an alumnus last week, which led to his arrest at gunpoint. Jacob Hoops was arrested last Friday, July 25th, at his home, where a whole team of federal agents ran up his driveway, pounded on his door, pointed their guns at him and his roommates, and finally arrested him when he opened the door out of fear for his life. The DOJ prosecutors allege that Hoops threw rocks at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, office, saying that one of the rocks hit a federal agent, which allegedly is how the officer got a 2-inch gash on his head. Hoops pleaded not guilty. The potential allegations are of less importance to many people than the blaring fact that the university willingly handed over Hoops' personal information, seemingly without a judicial warrant. Students and alumni of the college have started removing their personal data from the Reed College website. President of Reed College, Audrey Bilger, says that Reed leaders didn't know what had happened until they saw it in the news. Gary Granger, security director at Reed College, is out of office, and his duties are currently being handled by a staffer. Katie Rempe, head of Reed College's Alumni Association, says, quote, "Sharing someone's information without a subpoena or a warrant is completely unacceptable. If that happened, he cannot be trusted to be in that position," end quote.
Portland Mayor Keith Wilson has issued his first executive order, which will remove DEI language from city programs and policies in hopes to preserve $350 million in federal grants. The Trump's DEI mandate says that cities that continue to use DEI language and give DEI benefits will no longer receive federal funds. Wilson wrote in a letter explaining his order, quote, "This means that city programs and services cannot give preference to groups with protected class status based on characteristics such as race or gender," end quote. This is the city's biggest shift in policy in response to Trump's second term. The federal grants that would be withheld would make up about 4% of the city's budget, which comes out to roughly $350 million. Wilson explained that the majority of this funding would go towards city housing and transportation projects. Wilson said, quote, "Although this decision has been challenging, it is in the best interest of Portlanders. Losing funding would harm the very people that many of our city programs are designed to help." Many other states, such as Minnesota, New York, Illinois, and California, among others, are pushing back against Trump and his efforts to curb DEI initiatives. Some states have refused, and others have joined lawsuits to fight the directives. The director of the ACLU of Oregon, Sandy Chung, spoke with Wilson earlier this month and believes that Wilson's executive order is the right approach. Chung believes the city will remain focused on diversity despite the language change. Portland has opposed the policies in other ways. In February, the city joined a lawsuit over threats to pull federal funding from jurisdictions with sanctuary laws that limit cooperation with immigration officials.
Two beaver protection laws have moved through the Oregon legislature. Oregon is, of course, the beaver state. Beaver dams are important to our wetlands. They help keep foliage under control and encourage water seepage into the ground. That elevates the water table, allowing plants to grow longer and retain moisture. Thus, beavers indirectly help prevent wildfires. Their dams cool and clean the water, providing deep pools for young salmon to live in, and help ensure that there are insects and plants for fish to eat, as well as shade and protection. People still trap beavers for their fur. Sometimes this is done for sport, and sometimes because beaver dams can wash out important man-made structures. Recently, beaver hunting has become more regulated in Oregon. Our legislature has passed two bills that increase beaver protection. House Bill 3464 reclassified them as fur-bearing rather than predatory animals. Landowners must now get a permit to remove a quote-unquote problem beaver, and they must report that to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. House Bill 3932, passed this year, protects beavers by restricting trapping along waterways on public lands that are impaired. Those are waterways that suffer from high temperatures, excessive sediment, low oxygen, or high nutrient levels. About a third of Oregon's 300,000 miles of rivers are classified as impaired by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Some trappers think the laws have gone too far. Trapper Jeremy Watson said, quote, "You're taking these rights away on something that they're saying is a problem, but it's not a problem. There is no shortage of beavers in the state of Oregon," end quote. While environmentalists and trappers disagree on some issues, there appears to be a consensus that what Oregon really needs is more beaver habitat. Efforts are now aimed at building artificial beaver dams across Oregon. Unfortunately, it can take up to 10 years for an artificial beaver pond to grow the vegetation needed to support an actual beaver. Beaver protection ideas continue to move through Salem. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's Beaver Commission is several years into its, quote, Beaver Action Plan.
A Multnomah County judge ruled that the city auditor did not give former Portland Commissioner Rene Gonzalez due process regarding his campaign finance fines. The judge did not address whether or not Gonzalez had violated campaign finance law, however. The judge dismissed an over $11,000 fine on Gonzalez for misuse of campaign money when he was running for mayor. City Auditor Simone Reed fined Gonzalez's office over $9,000 when Reed's office found Gonzalez's campaign in violation of the rule that says you must return donations that exceed the contribution limit in Portland within 7 days. In response, Gonzalez's office created a report of instances where Carmen Rubio and Keith Wilson had failed to return donations within the time limits. Donations to political candidates are limited to $615 per election cycle from any given individual or political entity. Under Portland's rules, candidates for public office must also disclose top donors on advertisements. Reed's office fined Gonzalez's office an additional $2,400 for misuse of city staff time and resources when Gonzalez paid a New York-based company almost $6,500 to edit its Wikipedia page. Gonzalez ultimately won on the grounds that he was not offered a hearing to dispute his fines, which he argued is outside of due process.
Senate Democrats are relying on a rarely used 1928 law to get the Trump administration to release the full Jeffrey Epstein files. Hannah Francis has more on this story in collaboration with James Kemp.
Senate Democrats are taking a bold step to pressure the Trump administration to release files related to Jeffrey Epstein, utilizing a rarely invoked 1928 law designed to ensure congressional oversight. This move comes against a Republican majority that has consistently blocked transparency efforts regarding the president's dealings. Seven Democratic senators from the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee have sent a letter to the Department of Justice demanding the release of all documents related to Epstein's prosecution, including audio and video recordings. Under the law, if five committee members request information, the relevant agency is required to comply. This 1928 statute was originally enacted in response to the Teapot Dome scandal to increase public awareness of government corruption. This invocation highlights the urgent need for transparency. While it's expected that the Justice Department will ignore this demand, legal experts suggest that Senate Democrats may have grounds to sue the administration for noncompliance. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer stated, quote, "This is the law. This can be challenged in the courts." The situation echoes a previous attempt by House Democrats in 2017 to compel the Trump administration to disclose information about the Trump International Hotel, which ultimately led to a favorable ruling by an appeals court. As the battle continues to unfold, this effort could also make its way to the Supreme Court, potentially bringing further scrutiny to the Epstein case. With public interest in the scandal at an all-time high, sustained legal efforts could keep the media focused on the administration's refusal to act. Advocacy for transparency is crucial, especially when it involves powerful figures who may be implicated in serious crimes. With reporting by James Kemp, I'm Hannah Francis.
North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis wants Republicans to bolster Medicaid after cuts earlier this month. The economy blooms under President Donald Trump through red flags loom, and a new report examines state budget transparency. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I believe the president does not want to harm qualified beneficiaries of Medicaid. This bill will, in its current form. There's a way to fix it.
North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis says his party will pay in next year's midterm elections for cutting Medicaid earlier this month. The One Big Beautiful Bill creates national work requirements for the program and cuts $1 trillion from its budget. Tillis and others say they favor weeding waste, fraud, and abuse out of Medicaid, but he's joining critics of how the budget law's language would end health coverage for close to 12 million people. Since the megabill raises the federal deficit, it's slated to also trigger a multi-billion dollar cut in Medicare funding in 2 years. Laura Alpaul with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association says that will put all of America's hospitals and medical centers at risk.
Over the 10 years this act is designed to be in place, Michigan hospitals are lined up to lose more than $6 billion. And that's all of our hospitals across the state.
The U.S. economy seems to be rebounding in spite of President Donald Trump's rapidly changing trade and tariff policies. The president says import taxes on goods from Canada, the second largest U.S. trading partner, will rise to 35%. The White House says dozens of other nations will also now face tariffs as high as 50% after Trump signed an executive order raising the levies on most countries. But federal figures from the last 3 months show the GDP grew 3% in the second quarter. Kevin Hassett is with the National Economic Council.
There's blockbuster growth, way above expectation, and there's also a real almost collapse in inflation. It went down by about 1.5% all the way down to 2.1%, which is the Fed's target.
Other economists say both prices and employment are showing trade policy impacts below the headline numbers. The most recent monthly report showed increasing inflation, and the Federal Reserve says it's leaving interest rates unchanged. There's also a legal cloud over the tariffs Trump started announcing on Liberation Day in April. The president claimed the power to impose the levies under the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is normally used for sanctioning enemies or freezing their assets. A federal appeals court heard oral arguments and seemed skeptical, but Assistant Attorney General Brett Shumate argued Trump has the authority.
IEPA has been one of the most powerful tools any president can use to protect our national security, our foreign policy, and our economy.
According to global nonprofit think tank The Conference Board, previous presidents have used the law less than five times a year since 1990. Trump declared eight national emergencies under it in the first 100 days of his second term. A new report from a watchdog group finds states can improve fiscal transparency. The financial transparency score from nonpartisan think tank Truth in Accounting examines states' budget disclosures, including what independent auditors have to say, the accuracy of spending details, and the accessibility of information. Sheila Weinberg with Truth in Accounting says it's important information for voters.
Citizens need to know how well financially their governments are doing. Are they putting the citizens in risk of paying higher taxes or receiving less services and benefits?
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be sunny with a high of 85 and a low of 60. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with a high of 82 and a low of 58 degrees. Today in 2006 was the March of Pots and Pans. 5,000 revolutionary women for the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, or APPO, took over radio and TV stations to promote their message to the people of Oaxaca State in southern Mexico. The quote of the day is from an activist who helped found the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca. They said, quote, "The APPO was to be a space for discussion, reflection, analysis, and action. We recognize that it shouldn't be just one organization, but rather a blanket coordinating body for many different groups. That is, not one ideology would prevail. We would focus on finding the common ground among diverse social actors. Students, teachers, anarchists, Marxists, churchgoers, everyone was invited." End quote.
The Trump administration threatens federal cuts that could defund programs that help Native Americans in New Mexico integrate into cities from reservations. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. More than half of Native Americans in New Mexico live in urban areas, and many rely on programs to help them transition from their reservation to cities, including workforce training. But the Trump administration is proposing federal cuts that could defund such programs. Jeanette DeDios has more.
The Native Professional Advancement Center was founded in 1961 when advocates demanded the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Department of Labor create a workforce training program for Native Americans in New Mexico.
We have a large group of people that just make the urban setting a little easier for Native peoples. A lot of the times we're coming out of our reservations and into the cities for the first time. You don't really have that connection that you did back on the reservation.
Deanna Aguiar is a citizen of Isleta del Sur Pueblo and is Director of Programs and Development for the Center. It has 76 work sites around the state and has helped over 4,000 Native Americans access education. It also provides training opportunities and helps place people in jobs. Since 1972, it has been funded by the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act, but the program has been targeted for cuts by the Trump administration. Aguiar says if federal funding goes away, the center would likely be turned over to the state, but that could be detrimental.
We've been overlooked by the states just because we don't have a large participant base, and that often leads to the state overlooking us, and we end up invisible.
She says it's critical to continue programs like this to address poverty in Indigenous communities.
The poverty that our communities have been known for decades, to rise above that, we need access to education and good jobs. Access to that is not readily made to those who are coming off the reservation.
The program began its new year on July 1st and is safe for now, but Aguiar is uncertain if they will be able to continue in the years to come. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
Pacific Islander actor shined at the red carpet premiere for Chief of War. The miniseries stars Jason Momoa and debuts on Apple TV Plus this month. Hawaii Public Radio's Cassie Ordonio spoke to some cast members about playing Hawaiian historical figures.
Maori actress Te Awa Henepenia almost turned down the job amid concerns raised on social media about non-Native Hawaiians cast to play prominent figures in Chief of War.
I actually shared those concerns, and at the end of the day, it does not matter what I think.
Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, and U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, got a tour of the quote-unquote aid distribution site run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, in the city of Rafah in southern Gaza on Friday. During the time that the envoy and ambassador were being chaperoned through a highly curated visit, 82 Palestinians were killed across the enclave, including 49 people seeking food aid. More than 270 people were injured in the same time frame. In videos released from Dropsite News, there is an endless stream of injured and dead people being carted to the hospital in ambulances and carried by bystanders. This visit happens while Gaza is in a critical food crisis. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or the IPC, said in a statement released this week that, quote, "the worst-case scenario of famine is currently playing out in the Gaza Strip." They warn that Gaza has reached a, quote, "alarming and deadly turning point that will bring widespread death if immediate action is not taken." Ayad Amawi, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee and a coordinator for local NGOs, said, quote, "a theatrical performance is currently taking place at the USAID distribution centers, attended by Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff. A civilized distribution of aid, without repression and pepper gas, without gunfire and casualties, without stampedes," end quote. He says that the obvious objective of this staged visit is to, quote, "discredit thousands of video clips to wipe away the blood of nearly 1,000 starving martyrs and hundreds of wounded," end quote. Many of the 162 total deaths from famine alone have occurred in the last 3 weeks. According to the United Nations, between May 27th and July 31st, at least 1,373 Palestinians have been killed while seeking food. Since the so-called humanitarian pause put in place by the IDF on Sunday of last week, at least 593 Palestinians have been killed across Gaza. Almost 2,000 have been injured in that time.
Conservation groups warn the Trump administration's long-term plan for artificial intelligence will have environmental impacts across the country. Two Indiana cities are well ahead of meeting that goal, with seven buildings near completion and more on the way. Terry D. has more on this story.
The Trump administration's long-term plan for artificial intelligence could have far-reaching environmental impacts across the country. His strategy calls for the removal of land use rules considered prohibitive to the construction of AI data centers. Last year, then-Governor Eric J. Holcomb announced Microsoft would invest $1 billion to establish a new AI data center in La Porte to generate cloud computing infrastructure. Food and Water Watch senior researcher Ben Murray says fossil fuel plants are already being reopened to help meet high energy demands.
We just need to be aware that anything that prolongs our reliance on fossil fuel is going to increase the problems that we're seeing from the climate crisis.
Murray argues high-tech progress should not come at the expense of increased household energy prices. Resident support is low due to concerns about increased traffic and noise near the centers. The Trump administration says environmental and permitting regulations will only slow America's dominance in the AI field. A report last year found emissions from data centers owned by Apple, Google, Meta, and Microsoft were more than 7 times higher than officially reported. Computer servers using AI require far more energy than those that do not. A ChatGPT query, for example, can use up to 10 times more electricity than a standard Google search.
These companies can seem as if they're decreasing their emissions and meeting net zero goals, but in reality, emissions are amping up faster than ever for these companies.
Murray says the push for more data centers is already leading big tech companies to backtrack on their climate goals. It is possible to power AI services with renewable energy sources, he adds, but doing so requires political will. As of June 2025, a 1,200-acre corn and soybean field just outside of New Carlisle has turned into 8 Amazon-led AI energy centers. The tech giant plans to construct a total of 30 at the site. This is Terry D. for Indiana News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, announced today that the conduit for federal funds to NPR and PBS is shutting down. President Trump has signed a law that will rescind $1.1 billion in funding for public broadcasting through 2027. This comes after a congressional vote, 216-213, in July, that approved the cuts to public broadcasting as part of a $9 billion rescission package. The vote also cuts about $7 billion in foreign aid. Lawmakers could have restored some money for the following budget year, but on Thursday, the Senate Appropriations Committee did not do that. CPB President and CEO Patricia Harrison said in a statement, quote, "Despite the extraordinary efforts of millions of Americans who called, wrote, and petitioned Congress to preserve federal funding for CPB, we now face the difficult reality of closing our operations. CPB remains committed to fulfilling responsibilities and supporting our partners through this transition with transparency and care," end quote. CPB informed employees and their subsidiaries that the majority of the staff positions will end on September 20th of 2025, in just 2 months. A small skeleton crew will remain on until January to put the operations to rest in an orderly fashion. Trump and his administration have said that NPR is unfair to conservatives and a waste of taxpayer money. This comes as Trump's golf trips make headlines. In the last 6 months alone, Trump's golfing trips have cost American taxpayers over $52 million.
The Point Puzzle is a weekly puzzle. Every week, a winner from the last week will be selected from emailed answers and announced on air, and a new puzzle will be posted. It's time for the Weekly Puzzle with Pearl Stark.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to send me a type of rock starting with 2 consonants. Rhyme the word by changing the 2 starting consonants, and phonetically, you have a place where all rocks are found. Well, the answer is granite, which becomes planet. I do have to issue a correction because, of course, rocks are found in space. But in my defense, this planet is the only place that I've ever found rocks. Our winner this week is Kelly Lawler, who listens to WUTC in Chattanooga, Tennessee. For the new puzzle, I'm looking for a 6-letter word for things that are together. Swap 2 adjacent letters to get things that are apart. So again, send me a 6-letter word for things that are together. Swap 2 adjacent letters to get things that are apart. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select 1 winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Let's take a trip together, headlong into the irresistible orbit.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of July 28th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
As temperatures rise, mosquitoes are thriving, and urban dwellers may be especially vulnerable to mosquito-borne illness. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. You might think to put on mosquito repellent before going for a hike in the woods or a picnic by the lake, but the risk of mosquito-borne disease is not limited to natural areas. Many outbreaks of West Nile virus have happened in cities, like in the Dallas, Texas, and Phoenix, Arizona areas. So what's the buzz? Why is that happening? Robert Haley is with the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. In his region, southern house mosquitoes, or Culex quinquefasciatus, are the most common carriers of West Nile virus, and they're typically found near people's homes.
They breed in bottle caps full of water and French drains and overwatered lawns and anything holding water around your house.
Because dark pavement and rooftops absorb heat, urban and suburban neighborhoods also tend to be warmer than more rural areas. And these mosquitoes thrive when temperatures reach about 80 degrees.
In warmer weather, mosquitoes bite more.
As climate change brings warmer, wetter conditions to many areas, the risks of West Nile are expected to grow, and city residents may be especially vulnerable. So it's important to protect yourself from mosquito bites, even in an urban backyard. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 1st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is James Kemp and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Brian Bull, Isabel Charlet, Terry D., Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Pearl Stark.